Welcome to Stack Trace, a show where we talk about Apple news from a developer's perspective. And we have, as always, me, Guy Rambo, with my friend John Sandel.
Hello!
So, John, we were talking about doing short segments at the beginning of the episode, just mentioning what we've been working on, because it's a good conversation starter. So why don't you tell me, what have you been working on this week?
Sure. So I just came back from a pretty awesome trip to Portugal, where I was both doing some workshops with a client, but I was also attending the Swift Aveiro conference, which was really, really cool. So now that I'm back, I'm taking kind of a week off doing client work, which I'm normally doing, and I'm focusing on the new version of my site that I'm building. So I have the site called Swift by Sundell, where I post every week a new article about Swift developments. And I launched that about a year ago. And since then, the site has grown quite a lot to have many different sections. And I have a podcast there as well, and Swift tips, and all sorts of things going on. So I've been working on a new site to kind of have a better structure and some new design and things like that. So that's what I'm doing this week, just hacking on some HTML. I'm doing my own static site generator in Swift because, you know, I'm a little bit crazy.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's about it. What are you working on?
It's Chibi Studio season for me. Usually before WWDC, especially in the month leading up to it, I'm working very heavily in the WWDC for Mac app. So I don't have too much time to work on other things because I have a day job as well.
Yeah.
Which fortunately is very flexible in terms of time and stuff. So that's very cool. So it's Chibi Studio season. So WWDC is over. We have some new APIs, not that many this year, but some cool stuff. And I'm working on a big, basically, redesign of the app. We have had this idea of doing this since last year, but last year I wasn't able to do it, didn't have enough time. But this year it's happening, and I'm doing some work on the design side and also the technical underpinnings of the app with my designer, so he can make some better assets for people to create their characters with. Mm-hmm. And also doing some Swift on the server stuff, which is going to be used by the app as well.
Ooh, that's really exciting.
And I'm also running everything on a Mac in the cloud.
Ooh, virtualizing.
Yeah, actually not virtualizing. I have my own Mac Mini.
Oh, right. You have one of those like hosting services where you can put a Mac Mini and access it from anywhere.
Yeah, it's fun.
Oh, that's awesome. It's really cool that you're doing this design changes, and those for me, like those big design changes are always the most fun, but also very, very tricky, because especially if you're adding new features, maybe you want to take some time to kind of refactor things and change the architecture, but at the same time, you're also changing the design. You know, these things can be really tricky to kind of pull off in a clean way without, of course, throwing everything away and rewriting it from scratch, which I tend to avoid as much as possible.
Yeah, me too. There's going to be a little bit of that, especially with the UI, because the UI side of the app was not done very well, to be honest. But the app is modular, so the main component of the app is this framework I call Cuteness Core, which
That's
does
awesome.
All of the technical side of compositing and managing the library of items and stuff. So I have that, and that's going to change a little bit, but not too much. And the UI side is going to get a major redesign and refactor. And I think you liked my dark mode, right?
Oh, yeah, I loved it. It was very, yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, so we're going to have dark mode as well. And
nice.
I'm very excited for that. Before we begin the episodes, I'd like to give people an advice on Time Machine.
Okay.
Because I've had an issue twice already that I'm just using my Mac happily and usually working in Xcode and with terminal open, and all of a sudden I get a low disk space warning, and I go looking and like my disk space is my free disk space is dropping constantly.
Okay.
And I'm not sure what triggers it, but what I do know is that if you do Time Machine backups and you don't do the backup for a while, it keeps like caching the backup on your disk, so it can just copy the backup to your external hard drive.
Ah, so it like does it locally.
Yeah, and at some point it reaches like a critical state and something doesn't work right and the Mac basically collapses because it doesn't have enough disk space, and something's definitely wrong because the system should be smart to delete stuff that it doesn't need anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I use Daisy Disk to purge the purgeable space, which is what it's called. But I found that the best way to avoid this is to do Time Machine backups frequently. So if you are doing Time Machine backups, do them frequently, at least once a day. So that's my advice.
Ooh. Yeah, that's a really good tip. And I also love that you threw in Daisy Disk in there, which we'll definitely put a link to in the show notes, because that is a fantastic app, especially when you're an iOS developer and your disk space starts filling up with, you know, derived data and simulator images and things like that. And you are a little bit unsure what you can delete. You just don't want to nuke the whole like cache folder. So Daisy Disk is just fantastic because it has this super nice UI to see kind of what folders take up the most space, and you can go in and you can delete those. So yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to that one.
Yeah, so please do your backup so you don't get the disappearing disk space from hell issue, which is what I call it.
Yeah, I actually don't use Time Machine. I use Backblaze. Maybe I should use Time Machine as well, but I've never had one of those like time capsules or things like that, and I always just forgot to plug in the disk.
Yeah, so that's my problem.
Yeah, I just started using Backblaze. It just backs up automatically. So then I don't have to worry about it. But I should probably also use Time Machine just to have two sources of backups. But I'll get to that at some point.
Awesome. Before we start the show properly again.
There's a lot of build up this episode.
Yeah, exciting.
Yeah,
but this is like very exciting because we have a cool announcement to make. And
we do.
I think I want you to do it.
Oh, you want me to do it?
Yeah, you're good at those announcements. You're as good as Craig Federighi or something.
Oh wow. That's awesome.
So tell us, what are we doing this September?
Yes, so we have a super exciting announcement to make. A couple of episodes ago, we talked about that me and Guy, at some point in the future, we're going on a trip together. Not our honeymoon, right?
Yeah.
But we now are able to announce where we're going and what we're going to do. So we're super excited to announce that we're going to do our very first live show at the NS Spain conference in September. So both me and Guy will be at NS Spain, the whole conference, and we're going to do a live show there. It's going to be part of the conference, so it's not going to be any additional tickets or anything like that. So if you'll be at NS Spain, you'll get to watch us do this show live, which I think is going to be a lot of fun. So we are really, really excited about this and really looking forward to doing this live show.
And the timing is very interesting because it's either going to be right before or right after the announcement of new iPhones.
Exactly. It couldn't be better. So I think it's going to be amazing. So either we're going to play poker or we're going to go through the results.
Yeah, it's going to be very, very interesting. So make sure if you are thinking about going to NS Spain, if you can be at NS Spain and you want to see the show live, make sure you go to their website and get your tickets as soon as possible because they sell out really quickly.
Yeah, I think last year they sold out in 3 weeks and they already sold out their early bird tickets at the time we record this. So all you have to do is go to nsspain.com where you can get the tickets, and the earlier you get them, the cheaper they are. So if you want to come to the conference, which I think is one of the best conferences I've ever been to, I've been to many, many awesome conferences, but this one in particular is... it's very exciting because it's in this very small town in Spain called Logroño, which is in northern Spain, which is in the middle of the Rioja district, where they make all the tasty red wine. And basically the whole conference has like a wine theme. There's a wine tastings and there's a big kind of wine festival going on in the city at the time the conference is as well. So it's a really cool conference to be at because there will be many, many awesome speakers. There will be our live show and there will be many, many great events happening throughout the week, or not the whole week, but the weekend. Well, you can be there for the whole week if you want to.
Lots of wine.
Yeah, exactly. But it's going to be a blast. So make sure to go to nspain.com, check out their tickets, and we hope to see you in Spain for our very first live show in September.
Yeah, I heard the speaker lineup is really good.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty amazing. So yeah, really looking forward to that. We also have a new episode of our after show coming up. Our after show is our live streamed show that we do once a month for our Patreons. And this next episode is going to be on the 10th of July at 9 p.m. GMT. So if you want to join us for that one, which is, you know, every month, you get to join us for this after show by going to stacktracepodcast.fm/aftershow. That'll redirect you to Patreon. And if you choose to support this show with more than $5 per month, you'll get to join our after show, which last time was a lot of fun. So we hope to see many of you there on the 10th of July.
Yeah. And the previous after show can be watched, right? The recording.
Yeah, totally. So we record all of them. So if you become a after show patron today, you can watch the previous one, which was right during WWDC. And we'll see what we're going to do on the new episode. We're going to do some Q&A, maybe some live coding. It's going to be exciting. And finally, before we move on to the main topics of the show, we just want to say a very special thanks to all of our patrons. You really, really help us in trying to achieve our goal of doing this show every week. So if you like this show and want to see it become like a weekly thing, head over to our Patreon page and check it out. We're trying to, you know, introduce more and more rewards and cool things so that it will be a nice, cool thing to be a patron as well, because we really, really appreciate all of your support. And a special thanks to those who are our good friends of the show, which is Ken Barlow, Harsh Dubai, and Vigor. So thanks a lot. And now let's get on with the show.
Let's do this. So there's been some air power news.
Yeah, finally. We were talking about it on our last episode that, you know, air power, does it still exist? It's been kind of under the radar for a long time. So, Rambo, tell us, what's new?
This Bloomberg report came out about why Apple's air power is taking so long to make and that they were aiming for a June release, but they had some issues with the hardware, so they needed some more time to figure out how to make the device work correctly. And it's a challenging device because it can charge up to three devices at the same time. And that makes for some heat dissipation issues because the wireless charging generates quite a bit of heat. Mm-hmm. And apparently they are now aiming for a September release, so with the new iPhones. And that's what I was thinking when WWDC came and they didn't say anything. I really thought that we were going to see them only in September.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. Now that they missed the WWDC window, it doesn't really make sense for them to just drop it like during the summer. Because I'm also guessing that since it's been so long, maybe the product has changed in some ways, or maybe there's some new features of the new iPhone that they will take advantage of. So it fully makes sense for them to move it to September, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think many people don't realize that AirPower is not just a charging pad with three circles that can, it's not like one of those Mophie chargers, but multiplied by three. I would call it a smart charging device.
Kind of what I was expecting them to call it when they showed the product. I was like, this is going to be called like the smart charger or something like that. And then it was called AirPower, which I'm still not completely, you know, a friend with this name, but I guess this is something that maybe will grow on you after a while. What do you think of this name?
I'm fine with it. Don't know if it's the best name, but it works, I guess.
Yeah. So, like you say, it's not just the normal Qi charger is what they call them, right? The standard is just Qi standard, which is spelled QI for some reason.
Yeah,
because it would be funny if it was just like three of those, but it's actually like coordinating with the phone and it's apparently running iOS, like the AirPower itself is running iOS.
Yeah, that's a new information. And that made me look back to a device I know of, which is not being released yet. And what I know about this device, and just to be clear, I'm not sure if this device is AirPower. It could be another thing, or it could be something that will never even become a product. But I have information about a product that has an Apple A7 chip. So that's an old chip, and you'd think that AirPower would need a super powerful chip, so that makes sense. It has Bluetooth and Wi-Fi radios, a lightning port, an USB charging controller, and also a voltage regulator, and does not have a display. And the model identifier for this device makes me believe it's an accessory, and it's of the Air quote-unquote family of devices.
Ooh.
Which starts with B. So the HomePod, if I'm remembering correctly, is B298, I think. And the AirPod is B1 something. I don't remember the numbers.
I would be really impressed if you remembered all those.
Yeah, no, I don't. So this, I think HomePod is B238, actually. So this device is of the B family of devices, which is the Air family of devices. The HomePod is actually part of this Air family, let's call it that.
Okay.
And so, yeah, and I'm not going to say the model identifier because I don't think it's necessary. But yeah, I have information about a product with these characteristics, and knowing that AirPower runs some variant of iOS makes me believe it could be AirPower.
Interesting. And this is something that you find when you look at kind of there's somewhere in the OS, there's like a list of supported devices or something, right? That it can use for feature detection and things like that.
This actually comes from another source.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
A known undisclosed source.
Another form of spelunking.
Yeah. So yeah, very interesting. And again, people sometimes think that, oh, that's too complicated. Why would they do that? And first of all, we don't know all the features that AirPower is going to have. So we don't know why they would do this. But what we do know is that there's going to be a really cool interface. If you're charging an iPhone with AirPower and other devices at the same time, your iPhone becomes basically the interface for AirPower, so the screen for AirPower, and shows you the status for all of the devices that are charging. So that requires some interesting coordination between devices, and I think maybe that's why they went with the more complicated architecture.
Yeah, and if we think about it, it also kind of makes sense for Apple to use kind of the same hardware platform for as many of their products as possible. And we've seen this before, like with the Apple TV, we've seen it with the iMac Pro's like encryption or startup controller, that it's basically running iOS, right? So it's very interesting to see them repurpose these kind of older or a few generations old A series of chips in order to do more kind of general purpose hardware tasks, not necessarily running like, you know, one dedicated device with a screen and sensors. And I think that makes total sense, kind of just from my Admittedly, kind of naive perspective. I don't know a lot about these kind of hardware production kind of things. But it kind of makes sense just intuitively thinking about it, because Apple now, they have a lot of experience with these kind of series of chips. They build them in-house, they control the entire stack, and they've been really, really doing well with them. They're really fast, they have low energy consumption, and they presumably know them really well. So it makes sense kind of for them to use these as more general purpose chips that they can just easily repurpose instead of kind of building a new platform from scratch.
Yeah, because if they went with a more, let's say, traditional approach of using an embedded, a simple embedded ARM chip of some sort, they would have to develop a whole new software for that, firmware that would be specifically for that little chip. And those embedded platforms have more limitations. And given that they already have all of those chips, which are presumably fairly inexpensive for them, especially older generations, and they already have the software, which is iOS, which they can only it's not easy, but it's easier than developing a whole new platform.
Yeah.
They can make like a daemon that runs on this variant of iOS that controls the system for the AirPower charger. And the proximity stuff is required for the AirPower, because they have the status of the charging on iPhone. So it requires this coordination between devices and the proximity Bluetooth connectivity. Maybe Wi-Fi means that you would be able to see the charging remotely, but that's a stretch. I'm not sure about that. Having a Wi-Fi chip doesn't mean the device can connect to the internet. Those are separate things.
Yeah.
It makes sense. People think it's crazy, but I don't think so. I think it makes sense.
Yeah, and as you start listing these things, kind of what it needs, things start to add up, right? Like, it needs to communicate with the phone. It needs to have all these controllers and these kind of things that already exist in an kind of iPhone-like product. So as these things add up, you also get closer and closer to that, like, kind of trade-off point where you say, okay, instead of building something completely new that has all of these features, let's take something that's actually way more powerful but already has those things we need. Let's just repurpose that. And that's probably might even end up being cheaper, because they already have the production lines, they already have the experience and things like that. So I think it's really cool to see that. And another thing that makes me think of is, they're doing all this work now for performance, right? In iOS, like we talked about on the last episode. And I can't help to think about if they want to turn iOS to this more like embeddable, lightweight platform, that they would need to make a lot of optimizations under the hood to make that run with kind of low memory, even lower power maybe. And that could also benefit all of the other products, right? If things get more optimized.
Yeah, totally. And I think there's precedent. I'm pretty sure they used iOS as the firmware for one of those AV adapters they have. I don't know if it's for the new one with Lightning or if it's for an older one, which was the old dock connector.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure they have used iOS as an embedded firmware for an accessory before. Which was an even simpler accessory than the AirPower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting, and it makes total sense. It's just crazy to think, right, that iOS, which we were really, really impressed just like 10 years ago that it could run on a phone, it now like runs in a cable.
Yeah,
it's really crazy. So what do you think more about AirPower? So we mentioned that there might have been some kind of hardware complications with overheating and things like that. And, you know, that's kind of expected in a product that charges because, it generates heat and it's, transforms energy and these kind of things. But
it's very small and thin, so it's hard to dissipate the heat.
Absolutely. Do you think there also might have been some like software complications? Do you think that there's a reason they're doing this in September, that there might be something new in the new iPhones that they kind of realize that they're going to need?
I'm not sure about the low-level software. What I know is that the high-level software was basically done in early versions of iOS 11. So I think from the GM, it was already there. Mm-hmm. There was this component of the OS, which was responsible for the charging interface and the cool 3D animation, which I love.
Yeah.
And so that part of the software was very well developed back then, but I'm not sure about the lower level stuff. I know that I found a new entitlement in beta 2 of iOS 12. I'm not sure if that was already there in beta 1, but yeah, they're definitely still working on the software. And I have a hunch, this is totally like speculation, I don't have any information about this, but that these new like platter-based interfaces we have on iOS, where you kind of get a rounded rect that has all the background blurred, and it's, I think this is kind of where they're going with the redesign of Springboard,
mm-hmm.
because I've seen some things there that led me to believe that, but so I think maybe this interface was built upon some constructs that they were going to use for the new Springboard interface, which was supposed to be iOS 12, but then they decided to do performance for iOS 12 and leave that for iOS 13. So yeah, I'm not sure how ready it is, and I sure hope they keep the cool animations for this year's version, but they could maybe leave that for iOS 13 and release the device without the cool interface and make a simpler interface.
Yeah, that's a really interesting theory, actually. And it would totally make sense that they would use like a next version of UIKit or some new APIs that are not there yet in order to build this if they were under the assumption that they would be in this release. And that's actually probably a huge challenge for many teams working at Apple, where they're targeting, like they know they're targeting the next version of the SDK, but that's constantly like a moving target, right?
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah?
Because I think I need to explain why I have this feeling that this stuff is from the new Springboard.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever borrowed code from, let's say you have an app, and you have a framework with some sort of button, for instance, and you needed that button for another app, but you didn't need to bring the entire framework over, so you just gathered the classes you needed and brought them over. Have you ever done that?
Yeah, absolutely. Copy-paste-driven development.
Yeah, so Apple has done that, and they took some classes from another project and brought those classes over to use now before the other project was released or done. So
cool.
That's why I have this feeling.
Yeah, it would totally make sense. And this is a design direction that we're seeing them move in with many new features, like with the redesign of Control Center, with these like status sheets that pop up, like you mentioned, for example, for AirPods, which, you know, are really, really nice, I think, as well. And they're moving more to design language with more depth. And this is something that we could definitely expect for something like iOS 13, right?
Yeah, and even these dark notification-like interfaces that we have for Do Not Disturb on iOS 12, for instance.
Yeah.
The air power status when it's charging, the interface looks a lot like these new dark notification-like interfaces we have on iOS 12. And that's been there since iOS 11. So it's definitely a new UI design direction they're going to use, but they are not fully embracing it yet, let's say.
Yeah. Another thing that I love about this new design, and I was mentioning it to you earlier when we were looking at some stuff you're doing for Chibi Studio, where the rounded rects of many of these dialogues are actually matching the roundness of the iPhone X, which I think is such a nice little detail. And it just makes like I think it even makes like the device disappear even more. Like that's the beauty of the iPhone X in general, that it's just all a screen. But with those dialogues kind of matching the hardware shape, I think that just, it's brilliant. I really like that.
Yeah, I was working on stuff this weekend for iPhone X and doing these designs, and I really feel like I think Johnny Ive said in one of those videos that the hardware disappears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it really feels like that when you're working on something specifically for iPhone X. It feels more like you're designing for the hardware, because the hardware is so invisible that the software becomes the hardware, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really, really nice. And it's cool that you can build these more like vertical interfaces and things that they have a lot more space on the vertical axis, and you can afford a little bit more padding, and you can afford these more largely rounded rectangles and have them float in the middle of the screen and things like that. And yeah, there's a lot of cool ideas that you can now realize with the iPhone X, which I think we're just like barely scratching the surface on at the moment, because, you know, most apps, they can't only target the iPhone X. That's kind of kind of hard business-wise.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately. But as we get more and more of these style of devices, which has like a, you know, very minimal bezel, I think this is just going to keep pushing the design language forward.
Is it bezel or bezel?
I don't know. Basil.
I love basil.
Yeah, me too. It's the best spice.
Let's talk about laptops.
Yes.
Because laptops are really important for developers. At least I know they are for you and for me, and I think for a lot of our listeners. And there's been some news about MacBook Pros this week.
Yeah, exactly. There's been this big debate in the community ever since Apple first launched its 12-inch MacBook with the butterfly switches in the keyboard, and now later with the MacBook Pro kind of getting the same style of keyboard as well, whether or not this keyboard is actually good. And we can talk about many different things. We can talk about the feel of the keyboard, you know, how it feels like to type on, how fast it is, you know, whether or not it's too clickety-clackety or not. But there's also been like a lot of reports about people getting keys stuck and having really big reliability problems with this keyboard. So we've kind of been waiting for Apple to acknowledge this somehow, or at least like, you know, respond to it in any way. And now they have. So now Apple has launched a new repair program for all the computers that have these new butterfly switches. So that is the MacBook 12-inch and forward, pretty much. And they are now extending the repairs. They're doing repairs on the keyboard. And instead of having to, you know, pay a lot of money to replace the whole thing, you now have that covered, in many cases at least. So this is interesting, I think, that Apple, of course, they're not like saying, oh, we admit the keyboard is bad or anything like that. But they are at least doing something to try to mitigate this issue that a lot of people are reporting.
The way they worded the announcement makes me think that maybe they have some sort of manufacturing issue, and not all keyboards are vulnerable to the issue.
Hmm.
Because I know of lots of people who have been using these keyboards for a long time and not experiencing any issues. I'm one of those. Like, I use it, I type basically all day, and I'm not especially careful about crumbs and dust. I clean it every now and then, but I haven't had any issues. And our CTO at our company, he uses a 2016 model. Mine is the 2017 one. And he is also very happy with it and haven't had any issues. And he's also not very careful with it. And some other people have had several issues with multiple machines. So it makes me think that maybe not every keyboard is vulnerable to the issue.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought. And it's always like this with these kind of issues, right? Where it's almost like getting one of these bug reports that is really hard to reproduce, right? Where you just get a bug report like the app is crashing. Or, you know, that could, you could at least get a crash report from that. But maybe you get some bug report that, you know, oh, this weird thing happens in the app occasionally. And you try to reproduce it, you try to, you know, get in that right conditions, but you just can't do it. And it, you kind of start to believe as the developer, maybe the user is, you know, on some weird device that has some problem, or maybe they're holding it wrong. But often it's just like there are some external conditions, there's something happening that you were not aware of that is causing this problem. So yeah, like you say, it might be like some kind of manufacturing thing. It might also just be pure chance, right? It just might be because some people are speculating that, oh, it's because you were eating a sandwich or something and a piece of the sandwich is blocking the key. But it might not be that simple. It might be that, you know, it's just simple random failures that are not really attributed to some like specific cause.
Yeah, and it reminds me of the smart keyboard, because there are some people that have several issues with smart keyboards of the losing connection and simply not working. And some of them have exchanged the keyboard several times with Apple without success. And I've even seen some people say it's a software problem. But like, I have a smart keyboard with my iPad and it never ever failed. So it's very weird how random the issues tend to be. And but let's forget the reliability issues for a while. And let's talk about the keyboard itself. I was talking to someone recently, and I mentioned, I think it was right after the news came out of the, not recall, but the extension program. Yeah. And I said, I actually love this keyboard. And the person said, are you crazy? No one likes this keyboard. It's
traitor.
Crap. Yeah. And so I basically said, yeah, I do, but it's kind of like, I'm not trying to convince you it's good. I personally like it and you personally don't. I think it's, this is 100% opinion. You can't, it's like, oh, you don't like chocolate?
So, well, can you? Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a matter of taste. And I actually love this keyboard. I love the feeling. I type really quickly with it. When I have to use an older keyboard for some reason, it feels weird.
Feels like the keys are loose, right?
Yeah, spongy and not as precise.
Yeah.
But I do understand that many people don't like this keyboard, and I think maybe there are so many people that either love or hate this keyboard. It makes me think that it's too opinionated. Maybe they should do a like middle ground of sorts.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you design a product like this, or any product for that matter, you're trying to kind of swoop up as many people as you can, right? Who will like this product. And like you say, I think this product in particular might be a little bit too opinionated. And I'm with you. I really like this keyboard. I definitely prefer it over the old one. And whenever I go back to an old laptop, you know, the keyboard feels really, really weird. And there's like too much spacing between the keys and all that stuff. But at the same time, I can really understand, even though I like it, and even though I, you know, I'm comfortable typing on it, I can understand why some people don't like it. It is very kind of hard to the feel, and it makes a lot of noise. I mean, not as much as it did in the first iteration, but it's still pretty noisy compared to the old one. I think if there's something they can do to find a better middle ground, then it would probably be better, because with these laptops, they are so general purpose. There are so many different people buying them of so many different professions, and they work in different environments and things like that. So having something that maybe is a little bit less forward-thinking and a little bit less opinionated and more kind of boring and just old reliable would probably be the better trade-off, I think, in this case.
Yeah, if they came out with a new keyboard that has more depth to the keys and maybe a slightly refined mechanism, I think people like me and you who like the current keyboard wouldn't be bothered. Like, we would just keep using it normally and adapt to it. But it could maybe make some people who hate the current one actually start liking the new one. So I think it's in the best interest of everybody that they work on a new revision, and please don't make it so unreliable.
Yeah, because the thing is, with a keyboard in particular, you need it to work. Like, it's a very, very essential part of this computer.
And important.
Yeah, and with Apple's laptop design in general, it's becoming a little bit problematic, I think, that their products are becoming so kind of both opinionated, but also they're trying to simplify things kind of externally from a kind of design perspective. You know, they're reducing the amount of ports, they are making the keyboard simpler, they're making the touchpad or trackpad kind of just be this touch-sensitive thing with the artificial kind of feedback and things like that. And all these things are cool, all those things are nice, but it just really, really kind of increases the risk of failure. And whenever something does fail, it becomes a lot more critical. Like, for example, if I have 5 USB ports and one of them, you know, stops working, which happens quite often, especially as computers get old, it's not a big deal because I still have 4 other ports. But if I have a 12-inch MacBook and that port, you know, stops working, the computer is basically useless until I fix it.
Yeah.
So I think this is increasingly making the laptops, even though they might be well made, just from the kind of redundancy perspective when it comes to ports and input and all this stuff, it just makes them more fragile.
Yeah, a pro machine needs redundancy. So you can't call something a pro machine if you only have one part. Let's say they made a MacBook Pro with only one part. That's not a pro machine because, as you said, you lose redundancy. And I really think any machine with less than 4 parts can't be considered pro, because if you only have 2 parts, you are probably going to be using one for charging very frequently, and maybe all the time. Like myself, I basically leave it plugged in all the time. I rarely use it off the charging. So yeah, you need more parts, because if one of the parts breaks, you need to have other parts to use in its place. So yeah, I think that's very important for a pro hardware. And I think Apple they feel a sense of safety doing these kinds of things because they get it right so often. Like with iPhone 10, before it came out, and when we were discovering all of those details about the iPhone 10, people went nuts. Like, oh, this is ridiculous. This is not going to work. It's horrible. There's a piece of the screen is missing. And how are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? And people were going nuts about the iPhone 10 and how terrible it was. And it's a huge success. Yeah. And I think people at Apple, probably they have a hard time figuring out what's fair criticism and what makes sense and what's just people complaining about something they don't understand.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I definitely think there's a little bit of that where you could, if you would be mean, you would kind of maybe refer to it as like hubris or getting overconfident that all the decisions you make are going to be great because you've made so many great decisions recently. And I think there's definitely maybe a little bit of that where they are becoming a little bit more daring in their product design, which is also really cool. I mean, it's great when Apple is able to make these kind of bold decisions and move forward. And they have made so many decisions in the past that were criticized very heavily, like removing the CD drive or, you know, removing FireWire. It was called FireWire, right?
Yeah. There's no innovation without disruption. You have to disrupt something to innovate. So it bothers me because sometimes the same people that complain that Apple can't innovate complain when they do something bold like that.
Yeah, exactly. You can't have the cake and eat it too. Like, And there's always going to be, like you say, a little bit of cost to moving forward. And that's fine. You know, we can live with that. And USB-C with the ports thing and, you know, being very opinionated about the keyboard and all these things are probably things in the long run that is we're going to end up saying, well, it was kind of good that they made those because now a couple of iterations later, we have a better product. But the question is just like, how painful is the transition and what kind of measures are Apple taking to make that transition as nice as possible?
Yeah. What do you think about USB-C? I'm not sure I can comment too much on it because I don't use that many peripherals. So I basically have only two adapters. I have one that has USB and HDMI, and I have another one that's just a USB-C to USB-A adapter, just so I can use USB-A stuff, and I don't use those very often. And with my iPhones, I use the Lightning to USB-C cable. So I'm fine with USB-C. I have no problems with it, and I actually kind of like the aspect that you can basically connect anything to USB-C as long as you have the right adapter, of course.
Yeah, I really like USB-C, actually. I was very skeptical at first when I heard, you know, about all the dongles and all this stuff and people being angry. But I do like the idea of USB-C. I agree that it's not like fully there yet, you know, in terms of what you can do with it. But for me personally, it's working out really well because I have my MacBook Pro, which in your definition is not a pro machine, which it only has two ports. So apparently I'm an amateur. Is that what you're calling me, Rambo? Are you calling me an amateur?
You're not a professional.
Well, if there was someone who had to say it to me, I'm happy it was you who finally made me realize this. Anyway, so I've got my MacBook Pro and I also got my Nintendo Switch, and both of them have USB-C, which means that when I travel, I just bring one adapter, which is really, really great. So I can charge them both. And in terms of kind of connecting my computer to my display, because I run my computer in clamshell mode when I'm at home, I have a 4K display.
Oh, so that why you can live with a 13-inch.
Yeah, exactly. You can actually carry it with you.
Ooh,
it's a great feature of this product.
I carry my 15-inch around.
Ah, back pain waiting to happen. You can see here we're getting a bit competitive about which computer is the best.
Yeah, so that's why you are able to code in an airplane.
Yeah, I can even fly these low-cost airlines and still get work done because my computer is so small. You know, I can basically just fit it kind of between my legs, you know, almost down on the floor. And yeah, I can do some coding. It's great.
Do you think the 15-inch would work in the business class?
Maybe in the business class, yeah. Unfortunately, cool. It's not a common thing that I that I fly. Anyway, yeah, so I have the Apple multiport dongle, which is, you know, the one that gives you HDMI and a charger and things like that. So I just plug that in and that's really cool. However, it doesn't do 60 hertz for 4K. So for that, I have a dongle from Club 3D, and we'll put a link in the show notes to that dongle. It's really, really awesome. I really like it. And if you want to run your new MacBook Pro on a 4K display with 60 hertz, it's working out really well for me, at least. And I also want to say a big thank you to my good friend, Junior Bontgnali, who is the organizer of App Builders, who actually gave this to me. So, thanks, Junior, for that one.
Someone please give one to me. Please.
Yeah, you can just come to App Builders next year. Maybe you'll get one too. So I thought we could do a little fun exercise here. So we're talking now about different laptops. We're talking about, you know, how many ports should you have? What's the keyboard like and things like that. So I thought it would be fun if we could do a little bit of an exercise where we're trying to design the perfect laptop for developers. So,
ooh.
Yeah. So I think it's hard right now with the current Mac lineup, with the current laptop lineup, to kind of make a very clear, easy recommendation for people. It used to be like, just, it was just like a difference between the MacBook Pro and the MacBook Air. And people would come to you and they would ask you, you know, which Mac laptop should I get? And you would say, do you care a lot about like power, and are you going to do very intensive tasks? And they would say, no, I'm just browsing the web, checking email. Okay, MacBook Air. No, I'm doing more powerful thing, MacBook Pro. But now, all of the models, they have a lot of trade-offs. And we're talking about the ports and all this, all those things. So I think it's very hard right now to make a very clean recommendation without asking like 1,000 questions. Or what do you think, Yi?
Yeah, it's hard. I haven't been able to recommend laptops for people because it's a very personal thing. You never know whether the MacBook Pro is going to work for that person and if they're going to like the keyboard. So it's very complicated. I have issues with that.
Exactly. So, and also there are so many people who are like unhappy with their laptops, right? And that's pretty crazy because it's such an expensive product that you would hope that most people would be happy with it at least. So let's get started and let's try to figure out like what would the perfect laptop look like for developers. So now let's focus in on like iOS developers for now, because both of us are primary iOS, or at least working with Swift, these kind of developers. So where do you want to start? Like, what aspect of the computer do you think is kind of the most important for you as a developer?
I think the most important for me is CPU and RAM, basically. Mm-hmm. If we're going to talk about the internals, I think that's something that's very important. And I want to get the most powerful laptop I can.
Yeah.
And I do. Like, the 15-inch I have is the latest 2017 with the most CPU, the GPU, and RAM you can get. Okay. Which is not as much as I would like.
So let me ask you this. So, of course, like, power, like, CPU power has a lot of cost when it comes to kind of how thin the computer can be, how light it can be, what kind of battery life it can get. So let's say, would you take the trade-off of having a heavier, bigger, thicker laptop, basically like one of these gaming laptops? Would you rather have that and be able to get like more performance?
Probably not. I think maybe something a little bit thicker, because a little bit of thickness goes a long way in terms of being able to dissipate more heat and maybe have a bigger battery. So I would be willing to trade off a little bit, but not to the point that it's like those gamer laptops.
Not like an aircraft carrier.
Exactly. I think I would be willing. What I would be willing to trade off the most, I think, and which is something that I know many people disagree, and I certainly know Apple disagrees, I would be willing to have a little bit less battery life, because I think I don't need the amount of battery life that this laptop provides, and have it heat up a little bit more. Like, I don't really care. I know some people are really, like, they keep monitoring the fan speed and the temperature. I don't care. So if it goes to 100 degrees, I'm fine.
If you start smoking, then it's like, it's cool. No worries. I'm just compiling some Swift code over here.
And running Slack at the same time.
Yeah.
I would be willing to trade off a little bit. I actually think the CPU aspect is okay for me. I'm not that disappointed with the CPU performance. What I think we really need is more RAM. I know that 16 gigs sounds like a lot, but once you're running Slack and Xcode and the simulator and compiling a big Swift project, 16 gigs goes really quickly.
Yeah, we're definitely getting close to the era where 16 is going to be not enough. And we're going to look back at it like, wow, they used to you know, compile code with 16 gigabytes of RAM. Now we have 5 terabytes of RAM. yeah, definitely. I could definitely agree with the RAM thing. I would love to have more RAM. I'm actually also pretty happy with my CPU in my non-pro laptop. You know, I'm never going to forget this now, Rambo. You're going to hear about this for many, many episodes to come. It's just a dual core, but I also find that a lot of tasks that you do as a developer are not necessarily super parallelizable. So there's not a ton of things that take full advantage of like a quad core or, you know, even more cores system. And even so,
that's not a professional thing to say, John.
I'm losing all my cred here, all my street cred. It's like this guy who's using a 13-inch and he has only like a dual core CPU and he's perfectly happy.
But this is like one of those things where if you used one with 4 cores, you'd probably go back to your 2-core and feel like, oh, this could be faster.
So I actually had a quad core computer before.
Ooh.
I did. And I actually traded that in for this computer because I have very different trade-offs from you, actually, which is very interesting.
So I think portability is more important for you, right?
Yeah, portability is super important for me because I travel a lot. And like I mentioned, I love to work on planes and, you know, wherever I can work, basically. So being able to just like take my computer out of my bag and it's light and I can just use it anywhere, it's really, really valuable for me. But also battery life. And it's very funny because you said, I don't care about battery life. And I really care about battery life. This is a big reason why I love my non-pro laptop so much. Because it gets very, very good battery life. Like, I can almost squeeze 10 hours of battery life out of this computer. And that is, you know, if I'm, for example, writing, maybe I'm writing some new article or maybe I'm preparing a workshop or something and I'm like running Xcode from time to time, but not all the time. And I have like, you know, my text editor, which is IA Writer. I have that open. I can get a lot of hours out of this computer. And it's enough for me to be able to do some work like on a flight like across Europe, which involves like changing flights somewhere. So I'm on a road for like 6-7 hours and I can just use the laptop all the time. And this for me is so valuable.
Yeah, that's really cool. So I think just by the two of us, we can already say that they can't have just one model.
Mm-hmm.
I think having only one model is not going to be suitable for the most developers. And you could argue, oh, if you don't value portability as much, maybe you should get an iMac Pro or something. But I do value portability. I want to be able to just close my laptop and go to the office or go to travel. But I just don't value it as much as you. I still do think it's important for my computer to be able to close it and go away. But I really feel like having only one computer, which is my work computer and my personal computer and the computer I use at home and when I'm traveling, is the best way of working. I don't know if I had an iMac Pro at home, but then when I go to the office, I use a MacBook Pro, I would probably be thinking all the time at the office, oh, I could be doing this so much faster if I were at home. And I would end up not going to the office as often.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the benefit of having a slow computer everywhere. It doesn't matter where you are. I've been thinking about that as well, actually, to buy like an iMac Pro or at least a iMac and having that at home and then just having my 13-inch for travel. And this was actually pretty much my original plan when I got this computer, because I thought I'm going to buy this computer, which is, you know, a little bit less expensive. I'm not going to call it cheap because no Mac laptops are cheap, It's way less money than the 15-inch. So I thought, you know, I could probably justify having both. But then I've just been so happy with this, even at home. So I haven't found the need yet to buy like a stationary computer.
Yeah, I also feel very comfortable working with laptops. I know some people don't like working with laptops. They feel like the ergonomics are not as good as a desktop, but I got used to it. I've been working on laptops for a very long time, and I really enjoyed the form factor. And another thing I was thinking about, many people don't like the touch bar.
Yeah.
And I actually like it. I use it, especially when I'm using like Sketch, which has a really good touch bar implementation. But I really think Apple should offer a top of the line MacBook, which has just the normal function keys, given yeah. that the touch bar is not something that everyone wants and likes. And some people would prefer to have a physical escape key and physical function keys. So I really feel like they shouldn't make you have the touch bar if you don't want it.
Yeah, and we're getting into the same kind of topic here where, you know, it's very opinionated, right? And they're saying, if you want the high-end machine, you are going to get a touch bar. And this is one of another big reason why I picked the computer I picked, because I have the 13-inch without the touch bar. And I would love those two extra ports. I would definitely do that. But then I would need to have a touch bar. And I would also get worse battery life because, you know, the touch bar, you know, takes up some battery. And the 13-inch with the touch bar has considerably lower battery life in many tests compared to the one without.
But then you lose the Touch ID as well, right? So how many people maybe would like to have Touch ID but not have the touch bar?
Yeah, exactly.
And then it becomes even more complicated.
Yeah, a big problem right now is that Apple, they're like taking the features that people want and kind of scattering them across the lineup. So they're saying like, if you want an escape key, here's a computer, but it only has two ports. Or you want to have Touch ID, you also need a touch bar. You're not going to get an escape key, et cetera, et cetera. So I think trying to find a combination of these things that wouldn't involve kind of losing one and gaining the other would probably make people in generally more happy, because they could kind of get something that they want and maybe have to live with some trade-offs, that's fine, but not have to live with such huge trade-offs. Because for me, for example, losing the escape key, I mean, call me old-fashioned, but I really love to have an escape key, and I use escape key all the time. So when I did have the touch bar machine, it was driving me crazy. But I do like the touch bar. Like, I do like it for things like you mentioned, for Sketch and these apps that are really embracing it. But I don't want to take all these other trade-offs. So it would be nice to have something that was more in the middle.
I'm laughing because even though I like the touch bar, the it is weird to have a virtual escape key.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. It is weird and it takes a while to get used to. So when I'm using Vim, it's weird.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what we have agreed upon so far is that we need to make some big trade-offs versus, you know, performance versus battery life. But at the same time, it would be nice if we could have more of these features spread across the lineup. Is that kind of a fair summary so far?
Yeah, and there are many people who are not, they simply don't have an option in the current lineup. So I think famously Marco Arment, he's been talking about the keyboard for a long time. And he basically feels like there is no current MacBook Pro that is for him, because he doesn't like the keyboard, he doesn't want the touch bar, and yeah, so I feel like, and he's not alone. I'm mentioning him because people know him and probably listen to his story. So many people currently don't have a MacBook or MacBook Pro that they can use, and it can go on forever, because then they are basically going to lose customers, because and it's complicated, because if you're an iOS developer, you either use a desktop or you use an Apple laptop. I don't think it would be wise to make a Hackintosh notebook for iOS development.
That would be very complicated, I think. And it wouldn't, definitely it wouldn't be thin and light. That's for sure.
So there are many loyal and people who, loyal customers who love Apple products that don't have a laptop they feel they can use. So I think that's a genuine problem.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it could be solved if, for example, all of the computers had four ports, like four USB-C ports. You would solve a lot of problems with that. And if there was also a physical escape key as well as a touch bar, or maybe like the touch bar is smaller and there are some hardware keys next to it, but Johnny Ive probably wouldn't like that in yeah. terms of the symmetry that would be lost. And then if the keyboard could become maybe a little bit less, forward-thinking or opinionated or thin and would become more kind of a compromise, maybe feel more like the Magic Keyboard, which I think a lot of people like better. I think a lot of problems could be solved. And then you could have just what we kind of used to have, which is the only thing you're looking at when you're deciding which computer to buy is how big of a screen do I want? And how much power do I want? And I can upgrade that, you know, as much as I need, which you still can do. So if you want a cheaper or less expensive, I should say, laptop, you could have a 13-inch, but you wouldn't trade off as many things.
Yeah, I agree. And please, if you can, Apple, if you're hearing this, give us a 2 terabyte option.
For well. RAM. All right, so yeah, it turns out laptop design is hard. It's a lot of trade-offs, but I think these things are interesting to talk about, and I hope that we will see some changes going forward in the Mac lineup. So in the upcoming episodes, we want to dive a little bit deeper into some of the cool new things that came out in WWDC. We have our AR episode we want to do, and we have lots of things in the pipeline as well. So to stay tuned, make sure to check out our website. It's at stacktracepodcast.fm. Make sure to check out NS Spain if you want to see our live show there in September. It's nsspain.com. And you can also find us on Patreon at patreon.com/stacktracepod. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can find Rambo at _inside. You can find me at John Sundell. And you can find the show notes for this episode on our website as well. But that's it for now, and we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.